The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California time Space Show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. A couple of real quick, short announcements. The first is we're using the 60-minute format today. So if you have a comment or question for our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, please watch the time and make sure you do it while we're still broadcasting. That always helps. And then on Sunday, Dr. Casey Handmer of JPL is with us, and many of you have been talking about his blog articles on SLS, on SpaceX and their award, and quite a few other handy items. Apparently, he really puts out some very good information. Well, Casey is with us for the full program on this Sunday, so definitely you want to hear that program. And for today, our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we are a live talk show, so that sort of implies we'd like to talk. So please use the toll-free number. However, for those of you who still won't use it, we do have real-time email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Check out our website newsletter. It's already posted. But it will modify and change tomorrow. Everything we do is archived, and you can download shows quickly or listen off the website. Don't forget we have a store if you're interested in that. And then there's a listen live button that I need to call to your attention. This tells you how to listen to the live broadcast, podcast, and compressed MP3s that are housed on our website. If you need any troubleshooting or you have any questions, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then probably the most important part is to remind everybody that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. And listeners like you listening to this show today support us. And without your support, we would not be doing Space Show programs. So we're deeply appreciative of your support. And as a nonprofit, if you're a federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're lucky enough to be paying California taxes. And there's a big PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. But for those of you like me who are old school, you can make a check out to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation. It mails to Box 95, Tiburon, T-I-B-U-R-O-N, California, 94920. And since we're on the 60-minute format, I want to skip right into our program today. And I'm very happy to introduce all of you to Tom McCarthy. He is co-founder and vice president of business development at Motiv, M-O-T-I-V, Space Systems, which is located in Pasadena, California. And they're dedicated to developing the best motion control and robotic solutions for space. He's been with JPL, MDA Corporation, and other great activities. And they have hardware and are very, very interested in Mars. And they are on the surface of Mars, and we'll talk about what they have that's on the surface of Mars right now. Tom, if I can call you by your first name, welcome to the Space Show. It's great to have you on board. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much, David, for having me on today.
Introduce us to Motiv Space Systems. So sort of give us the 101 introduction so we can go forward.
Absolutely. So thanks again for the preamble. Motiv Space Systems is a small business located in Pasadena, California. We got started in 2014, early 2014, and really the vision was to attack some of the problems that each of us that that founded the company thought were relevant to our personal careers and domain knowledge. And so for us, motion control was a nice galvanizing interest for us, which ultimately leads to space robotic applications. And we thought that would be a growing market. And so we wanted to bring together really experienced electrical, mechanical, software engineers, systems engineers, and create a viable product that'd be robust and also provide new applications for companies, whether they be government-based or commercial.
Give us a definition. What do you actually mean by motion control? I suspect that that means quite a bit to different people. So how do you deal with or explain motion control?
I think the easiest way to explain it is if it moves, we believe we can do it. So if it's a robotic arm, all the joints of that arm need to move, and so that's our strength. If it's a gimbal for pointing an antenna, that would be one of the things that we could do. If there are instrumentation where you have to move lenses for optical systems and so forth, fine adjustments, those are things that we do. And so we provide the mechanical aspects, the actuation aspects, as well as the electronics that drive those things.
So a lot of companies have robots, are working with them, and they make them move. So you're talking to a person who's a more a business person, not an engineer. How do you differentiate your motion control from what others are doing?
So I'd say what we typically find is that there are experts in the field all over the place, of course, and
right, uh-huh.
and in some cases those are colleagues, those are partners, they're competitors, you know, all over the field. But I think there's very few in general who do all of those elements that I described in one place, in a small business form factor. You can go to really large NASA centers, and you can go to really large primes, and you can find that they have large organizations that ultimately can facilitate putting those pieces together. But they're usually done in traditional ways. For us, we try to have a really small, dynamic, blended team that is able to attack those problems. And I think that makes us very efficient. It also allows us to create some unique solutions so that certain things can be really small, certain things can be packaged really well, or in a custom way. And so, and also we are really, I think one of our greatest strengths is just the ability to work with our customer in kind of like a team environment. We're not just cookie cutter. We just have we like engaging in trying to solve the ultimate problem. And so we often ask the customer, you know, what is your application? What would you like to, what would you like to do? How are you trying to, execute your mission or this thing, and then we like to see through their eyes, and that often helps us in terms of creating a product or a development for them to help them execute their mission.
So again, you're not talking to a robot guy here, but what I may ask you may sound silly, but I figure if I can understand it, listeners will understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there let me do it this way. For space, I'm sure the robots have to make fine movements and detailed movements. But if I'm thinking of a medical robot that's going to do surgery and things have to be really precise, and let's say they're doing eye surgery and, you know, the object they're working on is really tiny to begin with, and, you know, the cuts and the movements have to be really tiny. So for space, does the robot have to be as making as fine or sharp or as small movements as, say, a medical robot? Do you have a lot more latitude to not be as precise? I don't know if I'm even asking the question right.
No, I think those are great questions. And so that's a great way to try to contextualize the question. So, for example, Well, let's take a slightly different domain. Let's say a big welding robot that builds cars.
Okay.
Right? So, so you know, it has to be precise in a way and repeatable and so forth in order to make the product of building the car repeatable, so that every car that comes off the line looks very similar and behaves the same way. But that robot, you could never fly, even though it's very capable, you could never fly that to Mars or another planet just because it's so heavy, right? It's so big. It's so massive for what it does. So for space robotics, in that example, it may have some similar repeatability, or there might be a little bit more allowance than maybe an automation robot. But its mass has to be so much trimmed down because the cost of mass in flight is very expensive. So in a lot of these cases, what we are trying to do is maximize the performance of the robotic system, all of its characteristics, its positional tolerances, what its the force it can apply, all of those things, but minimize its mass and volume, and then also create an operational profile where we're minimizing the energy consumed, right? Because the energy in this case would come from the rover. So we have to come up with, well, what's the right speed and the right trajectory that the arm should move at in order to minimize the drain on the power system so that operations can continue at a regular pace. So that's a unique problem because whether it's the automation robot for the automobile plant that says, oh, I can have lots of mass, I can build these stations up there and then have my cars come through. Or the medical robot, it's small and lightweight, but maybe it can use lots of plastics and lots of materials that you can't also fly in space because they wouldn't be structurally sound. So for us, we basically have a minimum selection set of all of those materials and capabilities and then try to maximize the performance with that criteria, if that makes sense.
Can you 3D print your precision tools, or is the technology not there yet?
So we will definitely 3D print as we build through the process. So through the prototyping process, yeah, 3D printing is great. Early on for us, it's excellent because it confirms design techniques early on. I think I don't know that we've regularly used like any metallic 3D printing in the build out as of yet, but we have been seeing advances in that in those arenas. So I don't think we're too far away. So that if there are some complex parts in the future, we could see some 3D printed materials start working their way into our system.
So down the road, maybe, at least I want to believe that we will have space settlements and people will be staying wherever the settlement may be, maybe free space, maybe on the moon or Mars. And that maybe there's some kind of a medical or first aid clinic or hospital that they have that can at least treat basic or maybe somewhat advanced conditions. So if they want to have a medical robot that does some kind of heart surgery or something here on Earth, would that same medical robot go to space, or would it have to be redesigned because of the mass requirements, the energy consumption, and things of that order that you've been talking about? Otherwise, could they just take a GE surgical robot for cardiac or something and just put it on board and off they go, or do they have to remake that thing for space?
That's a great question. So I would think that you would certainly start with the item that you said, like a GE robot. You would start with that, and then what you do is you would investigate that device and say, okay, what is it going to take to make sure that this thing survives the journey and can be installed in a facility somewhere else, Moon, Mars, wherever your settlement is.
Right.
My supposition is that, yeah, you'd have to re-engineer some of that, so that it would, because you wouldn't want it to, once it got there, it only had a very short lifetime because, I don't know, maybe there's the environment affects some of the materials that make up that system, that kind of thing. You know, it's just you would want to make sure that it was robust, and that if you're going to go through all the efforts of creating such a capability in another destination, that it could be serviced easily by the people that are still there if anything were to go wrong with it. So I think there is an engineering process, but you would definitely start with, well, what is the tool that works for me now, and use that as the kind of the inception, the start to get you going forward.
So I have a caller on hold, but one more question on this. Let's go the reverse direction. So you're in California, so like me, you know the cost of electricity here is probably the highest in the country. So can you take the benefits of what you're doing with robots in space, and since energy consumption is huge, you have to drop it down, can you transfer some of the space advancements and benefits and technology so that your robots you're using to manufacture that car or in the UCLA hospital, for example, are not consuming so much electricity? Because seriously, power is a really costly issue, as you know, in California and probably elsewhere in the country. So if those benefits from space can apply to our robots in industry and medical industry here, that's a pretty important benefit, I would think, coming from space.
That's an interesting question. I think that it might be a broader question, in the sense of, you know, I think for things like you said, medical robots or other systems, there's probably a lot involved in that system. They got to make sure that they're properly backed up and so forth. So it'd be interesting to see if some of the techniques that we use in space could be applicable to terrestrial devices. I will say that, at least for us, we built up some industrial robots that are part of our research and development activities, and there definitely is a healthy ecosystem that we've created between what we develop in our ground systems, if you will, terrestrial systems, and for space systems, and vice versa. So we will learn something in one of those domains and then realize, hey, we can actually translate that technique into the other system. So for example, for the robotic arm that we developed for the Mars 2020 rover, the Perseverance rover, we had to create a new force torque sensor in order to provide kind of a sensing system at the end of the arm so that it had a sense of touch. And over the course of doing that, we developed some additional techniques. So we thought, wow, this is really cool. We actually know how to build these things, custom shapes, sizes, to really fit different applications. We can start putting that into our industrial robots and start using that technology. So that's a case where by going through the process of developing for something for space, it kind of turned the light bulb on for us about different ways that we could approach those techniques for things that could maybe be utilized in a terrestrial environment.
Let's see who your caller is. Good morning. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hey, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Welcome back to the program.
Hey. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was looking at your website, and you have an exciting mission coming up with this OSAM-2, which I think you're going to put a robotic arm aboard a spacecraft to help with 3D printing a solar array. Can you talk more about that?
Yes. So our customer is a company called Made in Space. I think they're now Redwire. And they are partnered with NASA to do a demonstration of 3D printing in space. So for that customer, the technology they have is the actual 3D printing aspects, where they are intending to print beams in space that could be used for solar array construction. For us, we were selected as the robotic provider of that system. And so we are providing a solution to Made in Space to integrate into their spacecraft, which does a series of manipulation activities with their printing application, their printing tool. There are a number of steps that are required to start the print, to terminate the print, to then assemble the solar array system so that it can be deployed in as it's grown, printed or grown, if you will. So there's a number of robotic activities throughout that mission to demonstrate that that 3D printing application and this particular concept, which is extrude a solar array that you couldn't normally fly because it was too large to package with the spacecraft to begin with.
And are they actually producing a solar cells with 3D printing, or is it just the beams that would support that array?
They are producing the structural elements. The solar cells themselves, as we understand, the concept is those would be more of a flexible material, solar cell. So there's many companies that deploy solar cells that are unrolled or folded. I think they are implementing something similar where they have a technique where they'll unroll a solar array, and then the beam itself is printed from, you know, a raw material and extruded and then put in place so that that solar cell in application ultimately would provide power, large-scale power.
Okay. So I have a really out there question for you, thinking way into the future, and maybe it's not as far as we think, given how things are advancing. But how soon do you think we'll be able to have self-replicating machines when, you know, we can make copies of, you know, whatever you have, like maybe your robotic arm can make a copy of itself?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think I've definitely seen some impressive 3D printing advances, and I know there are some nice examples of dissimilar materials that they're able to use and fuse as a part of 3D printing. I think for true like replication, what you're saying, like basically taking a system and do it all over again, I mean, you'd have to have something that introduces a lot of different raw materials to make that work. So although I'm impressed at the advancement thus far, I still think we're a good 10 to 20 years away, but I don't know. It does seem like these technologies have moved very quickly.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's at least that, if not more.
Can I step in and ask you a question real quick with John still on the line? Do you think, Tom, that these technologies can move faster if they're experimented with and developed in space rather than on Earth for use in space?
I think that there's always, if you have something that you see as a potential big game-changing technology development, something that's going to impact our use of space, I think the ability to do a small scale or subscale demonstration in space as soon as possible is really valuable. That can be cost prohibitive just because of, you know, pulling something together and launching something. But I think the lessons learned are usually pretty invaluable. So there's plenty that you can do on the ground. You have vacuum chambers, you have test equipment, you know, you can simulate a lot. But I think I don't know if there's always a great replacement for true operational experience and time in space. And even if it's subscale, those lessons get integrated pretty quickly in the design process so that you can then make those next steps. So
okay. John, did you have another question?
Yeah, just one more. this is a great topic. You know, space obviously presents some considerable challenges, you know, with vacuum and, you know, temperature extremes and such. And, you know, you've got experience with that sort of testing and such. But do you have anything coming up on the moon in an environment where you've got the lunar regolith that could cause all kinds of problems with mechanical devices? And have you started to look at how you would mitigate those problems?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, that's a great. Great question. Yes, we do. We are working on a program with partners with JPL called ColdArm, and this would be a robotic manipulator that's going to do some science tasks, and it will go on one of these commercial lander provider systems. So there's a whole host of different lander providers under the CLPS missions. And so hopefully we'll know in the next year which one will be selected. But we have notionally a 2024 mission where we'll be building a robotic system. And the purpose of this, and it's a technology development and pathfinding mission. The point of this system is that if we can operate and survive and operate through the lunar night, without extra heating and so forth to keep things in a nominal safe range as has traditionally been done, we think that's a leap for developing systems that for human sustainment, for lunar outposts and that kind of thing. So for us, what the objectives of this mission are to create electronics that can operate, not just survive, but can operate at minus 180 C, and also have a mechanical manipulator that can also operate in those temperature regimes, as well as provide the sealing against the dust intrusion, because the lunar regolith, as many, many people know, is a very aggressive and difficult material to contend with. And to your point earlier, if it does get into the working mechanism, it can cause great problems. So the combination of all of those factors is something that we're looking at as an opportunity to create systems that are robust to their environments. Historically, you would keep survival heaters or do other accommodations to make sure that your system stays in a nice, cozy environment throughout its mission. Here, we want to test that. Those boundary conditions and develop technology that will allow us to operate in any of those environments that get thrown at it.
Are you exposing any of the robotic joints to lunar regolith stimulant, or how are you testing those environments?
Yes. So that exactly. So when we do our development cycles, we absolutely will try different. There's a whole host of different types of lunar simulants that are available. There's Mars simulants as well, and so some of the things that we've been testing is to make sure that the dust mitigation systems we have, whether it's levels of not shielding, but seals, levels of seals, are sufficient to keep that material from working its way into the actuation system. So that's right. We will go through those exercises, and then ultimately we'll fly this robotic arm and take it through its paces, and then hopefully show that it works across all those different environmental conditions.
Great. Good show.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, Tom.
Thank you, John.
Good talking with you.
Okay.
Yeah, nice talking with you. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Listeners, John has cleared the line. If you want to use the telephone, it's 866-687-7223. Email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. You have hardware on Mars with Perseverance. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So the robotic arm was something that we worked with JPL to develop and deliver. We're very, very proud of that system. It's pretty complex. It's about 2 meters long. It carries a 45-kilogram payload, so a science payload on a turret, and it's 5 degrees of freedom, so a little less. So your human arm is closer to 6 degrees of freedom, so it's a little less its workspace a little less dynamic than your human arm, but in terms of its capability, I like to use the analogy, like, imagine holding a bag of concrete straight out and then very delicately positioning that bag of concrete around to within a millimeter. And that's a hard job to do. So, and also to survive the launch loads and the landing and so forth and the daily operation. So it's an impressive piece of hardware. It has a really novel force torque sensor at the end of it. We talked a little bit about that before, which is responsible for making sure that we've applied enough load to, let's say, a rock that's going to be sampled, where the coring device removes a core from a rock. And then when it's retrieved that core and brings it back to the rover, there's a little docking system there. And so that force torque sensor also tells us, hey, are we well aligned? Is everything good? We're not jamming up, so that there's good, simple egress of the core from the coring tool to the sampling system within the rover. And then we repeat that based on the scientist's investigation and determining which sites are the highest priority. And then, so hopefully that arm will last a long, long time and support the rover throughout its operations. And then, so beyond the robotic arm, we also built the optomechanical systems for the MASCAM-Z. So those amazing panoramas that have been taken and shown. Our customer were Malin Space Sciences, and the PI was Jim Bell from ASU. Great team, amazing team. And so they're responsible for all of the imagery, and we're responsible for all that front-end work. So for the ability to zoom and focus, and then also do all the filter selections for the science investigation, we provided that instrumentation to them so that they could give us these amazing videos and pictures from the surface.
Did your company have experience building this kind of hardware on Mars? Or I guess what I'm getting at, did NASA take a big chance using a first-time company that hadn't built this kind of Mars hardware before? Or what experience did you have to bring to the table to do this? And obviously it's working really great, so it must have been great, whatever you brought to the table. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. No, good question. No, absolutely. I think so for us, when we got started, it said we had a vision of the motion control and the space robotics. And for many of us, even the few that had started up in the company and eventually as people joined along, many of us had worked at the various NASA centers, had worked in commercial industry, specifically in these domains, and where they had those strengths in the electronics or the mechanical, and they had particular heritage themselves as people who had developed systems for flight. And I think the big thing for us in our vision was, how best can we execute our vision? And the first step is to just have a compelling team of people. We need to have people that have great history unto themselves and then can build a history with the company. And when we bring in people that are early career, that they can grow and learn from those same experiences. So that's been kind of our philosophy. And I think that along the way, I think JPL and NASA have, in the programs we've been able to work with them, I think they've appreciated that. I think it's also made us a good smart partner for them as well, so that we're contributing to their team and their success.
Emails from Todd in San Diego, and he said, is the arm and the other part that you talked about, do they have independent power supplies, or do they draw power from the overall Perseverance rover, and how did you minimize the power draw?
So the rover is responsible for everything. It has its own battery storage, but it also has a RTG, so it's a nuclear heat source device which creates power. So that it's creating power all the time, and then they're storing energy as well from that source, so that if there are times where they need to, use a little bit more than what's in the what's in the power generating device they can draw from that. It'd be like, you know, kind of like a mixed system, kind of like your like a hybrid car or something like that, where you're taking advantage of different inputs of power. And so in that case, I think that when it comes to like how do we minimize power, it really goes back to making sure that when we size the robotic arm or we size the mechanisms for the camera and work with all of our partners to get the right motors and so forth, that we're not wasting. We're designing really to the application within the design margins as applicable to fly. We're not going way too far with lots and lots of overhead, so that we're very efficient systems. And that's everybody has to do that in order to make these missions. These are complex systems. These rovers are incredible. They require that from everybody to make sure that they have they can predict their mission operations very, very astutely and then execute on it.
So when you go to your website, you start out with X-Link, which is X-Link is the modular robotic arm that you're talking about. How is that different? Is it different because it's modular and that's what gives you the advantages, or what exactly is X-Link all about?
Sure. So the X-Link actually is the its first flight will be the OSAM-2 mission, the one that the gentleman, I think John brought up a moment ago. And so what's unique about that robot is it kind of breaks from what have been some traditional architectures employed for the planetary robotic systems that have been delivered to Mars in the past, and where all of its control and everything is all embedded in the arm. So that's why it's modular. It's the control electronics, the motor, the actuator, all the gear train, everything is built in a modular fashion. And that's a very unique thing. But it's drawn from some of our experiences on working in our industrial robotics. We saw advantages in construction and assembly, and we thought, you know, this could be a lot more efficient if we could find a way to translate these techniques that are used in terrestrial robotics and see if we could apply them for a space robot. And in this case, the OSAM-2, which is using this X-Link arm, is going to use just that. So it makes the interfaces to the arm very, very simple for the spacecraft because all of the control is embedded in the arm, so it's very just communications, power, and some bolt features. And there's your mechanical electrical interface. Very simple. And then we provide a command dictionary on how to run the arm. And then the customer can then execute the functions that they need for their mission. So, but that also meant that we, because it's modular, we could produce these systems much quicker and much more cost effectively. And for certain missions that are demo in nature, or short duration missions, this seemed like this was a great opportunity to fill a need that was going to be growing very rapidly over the next 5 to 10 years.
You have an email from Sally in Chicago, and she says, I'm curious if your responsibility for the hardware ends when you deliver it to NASA. For example, I'm assuming NASA is in charge of integrating everything, and then they get it on the rocket, and off it goes to Mars, and then it lands. Do you have anything to do with it once you've delivered the product and it's been certified to NASA, or do you participate in operations on the Martian surface? Where do the lines go with what you do and what you don't do?
That's a really great question. Excellent question. So, for us, usually what happens is when we've taken the, in this case, the arm, you know, the piece of hardware that we're about to deliver, we've taken it through a sequence of environmental tests to make sure that in vacuum and temperature, it's compliant, it's working, everything's great. And then it'll go on a vibe table. We shake it. All those different types of tests. So at that point, then we work with our customer, and we usually support some of the early integration activities. We play a role so that we are in a transfer of responsibility at that point, but we'll play a role because we've spent, in this case, several years with this hardware, know the ins and outs of it. And while our customer is very knowledgeable of it as well, we definitely work to those first few steps and make sure that things go through the integration process to the rover very smoothly, and we support that. And then along the way, what happens is there may be testing that is done by the customer, and we are there to provide them with, if we had done earlier testing or other analyses, and they have questions that come up, and they want to understand, oh, hey, how did you guys test this, you know, a while back? And we refresh those notes and compare against what we're seeing now, make sure that nothing has changed, everything looks the same. So we'll play a role to get them to the point where they have total ownership of the hardware. And then going forward, we're basically in a support role. Quite frankly, it's great if the phones are quiet during those first days of operations, because you want to know that everything's going well. But every now and then they'll check and say, hey, we're about to do something. We just want to make sure that, you know, our numbers look good. So they'll keep us in the loop. But it's really, yeah, once we deliver, you know, they take ownership, and then we're there as a resource for them.
So you don't do anything unless they ask you for help once it's on the surface of Mars. It's all up to NASA to operate.
That's right.
Everything.
That's right. That's right.
And I'm assuming they play probably a pretty critical role in design and development and R&D and everything right from the start, correct?
They play a critical role in that mission architecture development. So they have basically gone through every system on that rover, and they've made the allocations, and they've defined the performance based on what the scientist says they want to do and what they're trying to accomplish. And so translating that information and those needs and those objectives into boundary conditions for us that say, hey, we can allow you so much volume when you package your robotic arm. Here's the mass. Here's the power we got to operate in. And we do the best we can to stay within all of those constraints. Every now and then, there might be a little tweak because an instrument is changing or a capability needs to be pushed. And they said, hey, can we accommodate that? And we might have to iterate a couple of times. But in general, they play a very critical role in really setting the early tone for what the design should be based around. And then from there, when it comes down to the details and working all the finer points, That's where we're strong, and that's where we go and go to work, and then but we are engaged with that customer the whole way through to make sure that what we're doing is also fitting within their mission architecture.
Another email from Boston. This is from Jack, and he says, I'm curious if, say, the arm was put out to bid and you have to bid and compete for the job for NASA, or did you get it because you're the only ones doing this kind of work and they knew that and so this is what they wanted?
In this case, we did compete. This was put out to bid. We did compete and win this opportunity. There's different programs, different ways they start can come out of different different partnerships and so forth. Sometimes, like for example, for the one I talked about before, the cold arm, in that case, we teamed with JPL, and they bid. We brought a certain technology capability, and they had a certain technology capability, and we had a concept of a robotic system, and so we joined a team that bid and won. It just depends. All of these missions and elements are constructed in different ways.
Have you ever had the opportunity, are you working with any of the entrepreneurial private companies that say they want to go to the moon and they're kind of separate from NASA. Do you do anything with the startups or the entrepreneurs or maybe even anything that might be related to space tourism down the road?
So we have not specifically worked with any of them. We definitely see them in the community. We go to workshops on occasion that look at, you know, future exploration, some of these things that where space tourism is talked about. I think that in the initial phases, like where our strengths play, it's probably too early for those groups. I think they have some goals of early space tourism and building up a large following and so forth. And as their industry grows, then I think there's probably an opportunity for us to work with them because they'll be looking to do, you know, bigger and better things to support that burgeoning industry. But right now, like I said, they're members in our space community, but we haven't had opportunity to do anything specifically with them yet.
Alexander is in Kansas City with an email for you, and he says, I'm looking at your website, and you talk about satellite servicing, and then you have an OSOM 1 and an OSOM 2, and you've talked a little bit about OSOM 2. What is actually the difference is in OSOM 1 and OSOM 2? And satellite servicing seems to be a catchword for lots and lots of companies these days. I'm not sure any of it exists yet. What are you doing different from others with satellite servicing, and do you have a timeline where any of this is actually operational?
Okay, very good, very good. So, yeah, okay, well, let's start with the OSAM moniker there. So OSAM, at its root, stands for Orbital Servicing and Assembly and Manufacturing. So so the OSAM-1 activity, that's being managed out of NASA Goddard, and they have been for many years developing a suite of technologies to actually go and do satellite servicing activities on orbit. So what is satellite servicing? Satellite servicing means you can repair an asset on orbit. You could refuel an asset on orbit. You might relocate that asset. So let's say you're in one orbit avenue and you want to increase its inclination. You can do that or raise from let's say a geo to its graveyard orbits. So the idea is that you have a spacecraft that is going to go and do work, some kind of work, in support of another one to extend its life, to add new capability. Maybe the original satellite was just fine and it's got lots of lifetime, but its technology has aged over time. And you could easily adapt a new set of transponders, communications, or so forth, to increase its capability. These are things that I've talked about that are in the realm of satellite servicing. So, in terms of operational, what's operational? Well, Northrop Grumman, in the last year, has successfully docked with two commercial spacecraft. Both operated by Intelsat, where they had a spacecraft called the MEV. They actually went and docked with it. It was able to use a mechanism to reach through the propulsion thruster and then clamp onto that. And then now the Northrop system provides the attitude control system for that old aging spacecraft. And the reason they did that was because the old spacecraft was slowly running out of fuel, and they were either going to have to basically dispose of it, or they could get, I think, 5 more years of life out of it, and all of its systems were working beautifully. And so to them, that was a great business case. They said, wow, we can still provide good service to our customers, and we've basically upped our operational lifetime. So that's actually happened twice, and that's really some of the first steps of that industry, showing viability of somebody actually doing that and in a commercial fashion. So for us, so we're not operators, but what we do provide, it talks about motion control. So in some of those operations, they show or they utilize robotics to do repair, to refuel, those kinds of services. So we have developed electronic control systems for driving those robotics and provided those to NASA. And they've been testing with those systems for the last 5 or 6 years, developing algorithms for how they may grapple a system. Let's say the system has run out of fuel, it's slightly drifting, they can actually capture that system and stabilize it and then provide service to it. So those are the technologies that NASA has been investigating, and the commercial industry has also been developing some of their own. So it is an industry that exists and actually is operational.
So Northrop Grumman would use your motion control hardware. Am I understanding that right?
So they can, they could, they may. I can't say specifically, but yes. Yes.
But you're not making the start to finish actual full system. You're making components for these systems.
For some of these systems, we would provide components. That's right, to help them execute their mission. That's right.
I know we're coming up short on time. You are in Pasadena, which for people who may not know is close to Los Angeles or part of Los Angeles. I'm looking at your career openings, and I mean, you've got openings for robotic software engineer, mechatronics engineer, systems engineer, electrical engineering, controls engineer, quality engineer. I mean, you got a. Do you really have these? Is your business and the industry growing to the point where you really have these kind of openings for people? And is it hard to find people, or why are these positions still open?
No, absolutely. We are growing. We're definitely growing. It's been an exciting journey over this last 7 years from the point of start of the company, where we started out just, you know, some small jobs to just get going. And then we won some flight programs. And now we're at a point where our customer base is growing, and it's evolving quite a bit between government and commercial applications. And we are seeing a growth in the robotics sector in general. And so all of those positions play a key role in the future systems that we're developing for a whole host of customers. So we have a great team. We've been growing a great team, a multidisciplinary team, and we are always looking to add to that team because we feel that we're providing new technology in an area that hasn't been looked at for a long time, and plus that area is changing quite significantly. The more and more you hear about people talking about, oh, we'll just put some robots in space, that wasn't always the case. People, you know, it used to be a robot happened every once in a while. But now it seems like robots and more complex applications are expected now because we want to do building in space. We want to do habitats on the moon. We want to have exploration to Mars. Robots and smart computing systems have to play a huge role to support human expansion that way. So if that's really where we want to go, then the robots are absolutely going to follow. In some cases, they're going to lead in order to make that capable.
Do you have internships available too?
On occasion we do. It's what we'll do is we ask people to go ahead and submit their resumes, and then sometimes toward the summer time frame we'll have a few interns. We do that as well.
They just submit online, I guess, by clicking contact,
mm-hmm.
right? Something like that.
Yeah, I think in there should be a like anywhere for when they're looking for the positions. There should be like a resource there for submitting for inquiries about future positions or internships.
This is kind of a fun question I think it's fun. You may not think it's too fun, but this is Alex in Tucson, and he says, I'm just curious, given all the news we get about California and job positions and cost and everything else, are you located in Pasadena because you do so much work with JPL, and that's a reason to be in Pasadena, or is there any other reason you feel that it's worth being in Pasadena or California, given all of what is reported about California in business? In fact, it just got rated number 50 out of 50 as the worst state to do business in. So are you there because of JPL?
So I'll say, first and foremost, most of us are here because we kind of grew up in the area. And a number of us that had actually worked for JPL in the past, or we've worked with JPL based on, you know, where our career journeys took us. Southern California can be a really nice place to live. It is competitive from a business standpoint. No argument. He makes a great point. It is hard. Taxes here are high. You know, there are lots of things because it's competitive. It's got good weather and there's a lot of metropolitan areas here to support industries like aerospace. And so I think with anything, if you just take the whole complexion of it, you know, there's a lot of positives, but that means a lot of people want to be there too. So sometimes that generates a balance to business too. So I think for us, we really like being here. We do like being in proximity to JPL because that's a community we're familiar with. We enjoy that community. But at the same time, we don't just work for JPL. We do work quite a bit of work on the East Coast. So the DC area is a big aerospace area, Colorado, big aerospace area. And we're growing, in different areas of the country as well. So I think that's it. Most of us just happen to be in the area. We like the weather, and aerospace is kind of fun for us.
We're pretty close to the end of the hour that we talked about. Have we forgotten anything, omitted something? Is there something else you'd like to tell us about the industry or motive or even yourself that we haven't touched upon yet?
No, I'd say this was a lot of fun. Really appreciate the opportunity to come on your show. And I thought the questions were great, very engaging. And for us, I think that, hopefully people stay tuned. I think we're in an exciting phase of the company. We're growing. I think the Mars activities were a good first step for us, and a very prideful moment for us to be able to do those systems. But going forward, I think that we'll play a big role in the space community.
I just got an under the guideline email that I'll ask you real quick from Sandra in Las Vegas, and she says we see so many companies taking advantage of SPACs going into ETFs, and do you have any plans for going public, doing a SPAC, maybe being acquired by Voyager Space Holdings, something like that? Should we be on the lookout for that to happen?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. I would just say this, that for those of us that started the company, we really enjoy our day-to-day. There's a lot of freedom when you get to, the decisions are made within a small group of people, so things can be flexible and fast, and we try to create an environment that provides growth opportunities for the people that work at the company and try to pursue really interesting and novel work. And in a lot of ways we get spoiled, I think, because we get to do that. And the important thing is for us is to stay hungry. So I don't know. I don't know what's in the future. Anything is possible. We definitely have seen lots of traffic in that arena, as she pointed out. But I really don't know. But we are really enjoying what we're doing today.
Well, it's really great to make contact with you, and I hope we can touch base and stay in touch down the road and talk to you more about robots and the kind of technologies and things that you're developing. It's a fascinating world. And we appreciate your giving us an hour. I know you had to postpone a meeting for this, and some other things. So we truly do appreciate it, and I want to thank you very much for being here. And we'll hopefully get a chance to talk again down the road. It's a fascinating field, and you've explained it to us really well. So until the next time, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. I thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun. And, yeah, if ever wanted to do it again, just let me know.
We'll do. And, listeners, we want to thank Tom for being here, for John's call and your emails. And the weekend is here, so have fun and keep safe and keep looking up, as we like to say on the Space Show. So goodbye from Tom, David, and the Space Show. Back again Sunday. Once again, the Space Show signs off for Friday.